Hi, welcome to this week's program. You probably don't want to talk about this right now after having seen your investments squiggle up and down 10% every week, but today I do want to share some thoughts on investing that could help you make the right decisions going forward. In times like these, when there are big market drops and increased volatility, you may think you need to suddenly change your investment strategy. And this started me thinking about the many investment fads that come and go over an investor's lifetime, and I have seen many of them. To paraphrase the famous Nobel laureate Eugene Fama, who once said something to the effect that there's one significant new idea in finance maybe every 10 or 15 years, but there's a new marketing idea every week. So, a marketing idea as opposed to an investment idea, what do you think he's saying? I think he's saying that great investment ideas are normally evolutionary, taking years to perfect and bubble up through the noise. Ideas like value investing, the idea of mutual funds so many years ago, exchange-traded funds, quantitative investing, and modern portfolio theory took decades to develop and become part of the mainstream. And even with all those years, professionals still argue about their merits all the time. Marketing ideas, however, are born out of the commercial need to drum up new business, and some American companies and many so-called investment advisors slickly specialize in this area. So, should you be looking to make major changes in your portfolio, make sure you're sticking to the tried and true and don't jump on the latest investment fad of the day. And maybe don't do anything at all, but if you must, realize that it's a bit like locking the barn door after the horse is already gone. It would probably have served you better had you done that before the market dropped more than 10% in just a few days. Changing your investment strategy to fit an event that's already occurred doesn't usually work out too well. So let me tell you a little bit about the history of various investment fads so you can easily see how many of them have come and gone. In the 60s and 70s, the great rage of the time was an investment in Nifty 50 stocks. Those were a group of large-cap blue chips, which were often described as one-decision stocks because they were viewed as extremely stable, even over long periods of time. Of course, that stability came at a high cost, as most of them sold at sky-high P/E ratios, resulting in valuations that were far in excess of the true value of the business. Many survive to this day, but many, many do not. All in all, though, the returns were less than stellar. And if you missed just a few of the good ones, the returns were a complete disaster. The late 1990s and early 2000s saw a lot of focus on the BRIC markets. Do you remember those? BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And they did well for a while and then lost a good deal of money. There was also the dot-com bubble fad, followed by the bubble burst, when many investors threw money at any stock that was even remotely connected to the internet. The idea was kind of right. But the investments were awful. I remember the biotechnology fad in the 80s when the potential of a new world of eradicating disease was the marketing promise of the day. As with all of these, the ideas have merit, but which companies succeed and when is always the great unknown. The 2008 financial crisis spawned plenty of new strategies, such as black swan strategies. And for those of you who may not know, the coronavirus is not, according to Nassim Taleb, the creator of the term, an example of a black swan event, meaning that it was an event that was predicted but could not be timed. A typical black swan episode is a totally unforeseen event. Now, today, the current popular investing trends continue to be strategies that aim to profit by identifying, or guessing, if you will, who the ultimate winners will be among cryptocurrencies or the cannabis companies. Often, an investment fad explodes onto the scene and glows like a supernova, flaring out once reality sets in. We saw a great example of this with the cannabis company Tilray, which IPO'd at 17, soared to 300, and now currently sits at 6.5. So why don't trendy investment strategies usually work? In large part, because most of them are aiming to do something that's simply nearly impossible to do. Outguess the collective wisdom of tens of millions of investors whose actions ultimately determine the prices of stocks. Also, investors are operating under the greater fool theory, in which investors have the hope that they will sell their stock to a greater fool than they were. Yes, there are stories of someone occasionally outsmarting the overall market for a period of time, but such stories, the true ones anyway, are few and far between, and they don't tend to remain true over the long haul. For example, I know one seasoned investor whose advertisements today tout that he bought Microsoft at 3 and Amazon at 10 and so on. What he doesn't advertise is that he ran a hedge fund that blew up because his overall investment performance was so miserable. So what are some of the smart moves you should consider making right now in regard to your investment portfolio? Well, it's certainly a good time to sit down with your financial advisor and do a normal review of your portfolio. And if you've been hiding your head in the sand, you know, it's safe to come out now, okay? If you're considering adding some new assets or strategies to your investments, the first thing to check is whether they will actually add something to your portfolio that's not already in there. Then you can discuss with your advisor or your dad or your mom, whoever knows more than you, whether making some changes is likely to help you better achieve your goals and be in line with your risk tolerance. It's also a good time to consider offsetting any gains you may have by selling some losing stocks and taking your losses. Also, consider the relative tax advantages of one investment over another and review your fees and transaction costs to make sure those are as fair as possible. In the end, most investors do better simply by staying disciplined during times of increased volatility and market uncertainty, rather than by making rash, impulsive changes to their overall strategy. What I like to say is that both you and your portfolio should be quarantined right now. Now, and just as in the world of fashion, investing fads come and go, but if you're going to invest in individual companies, please make sure you understand the business, the balance sheet, their competition, and the possible future rate of return based on the current stock price and a reasonable forecast of future earnings. If you can't or don't want to do that, stick with getting just the right funds to satisfy your long-term goals. As you know, my mission is always to educate my listeners, and I remind you week after week, segment after segment, that we love your questions, because we do. These are complicated times, which makes for complicated topics, and I'm always here to answer them. So, if you have questions about your portfolio, your kids' kids, your retirement, your 401k, how to take better care of your family, anything financial on your mind, I'm here with over 35 years of experience, and I'd love to help you in any way I can. Go to stevepomerantz.com, go to the contact section, and let me know how we can help. That's stevepomerantz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. With coronavirus all over the news, I wanted to get a good idea of what drug companies may be doing in order to create new treatments for this virus. So I've asked Meg Terrell from CNBC to join me. Meg has tracked public health emergencies from Ebola to Zika, so I think she has something to add to the discussion, and she's with me on the phone right now. Hey, Meg, welcome back to the show.
Hi, happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you. You know, last we spoke on February 19th, when at that time the virus had not truly entered the U.S. on a large scale. So I wanted to get caught up with regards to medical research, possible vaccines or cures, and where you see us today. So let's start with testing.
Sure.
There seem to be different kinds of tests, from antibody tests to tests where, you know, you can be swabbed and have the results back in a week or so. What's the state of the art with that right now?
So testing capacity has ramped up dramatically in the United States from where it was. It got off to a really rocky start, of course, with the CDC-provided test having some issues. Now, commercial companies have come in, commercial labs have come in, and the U.S. is running something like, you know, more than 100,000 new tests per day. That's still not enough. You know, what everybody says is we need to have a much greater testing capacity if we're going to be starting the economy back up again. We need to be able to know who's infected, where the outbreaks are. And, you know, even though we have the tests themselves, there are a lot of reports of shortages in the materials needed to run the tests, from even the simple things like nasal swabs, those long Q-tip-like things, they stick really far up your nose to be able to take the test. Also, the protective equipment for the people who are administering the tests, they need to be protected because when they stick those things so far up your nose, sometimes you can cough or sneeze. So they have to be protected from that.
Right.
So just a lot of issues. There's a real clunkiness in our testing infrastructure in this country being revealed by the great need we all have for tests right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also a reluctance I've read to switch platforms, meaning that once a hospital or a group starts using some kind of tests, whether they're the most efficient or not, it's hard to get them to switch to another test. Have you seen that?
Yeah, that was something that Dr. Debbie Birx mentioned in one of the coronavirus task force briefings from the White House. She's the sort of one of the coordinators of this response. She pointed out that there are all of these tests provided by Abbott that can be run, you know, millions of tests out there, but they're not getting run because a Roche test was available first. And so people were just used to ordering the Roche test. But if there are backlogs, you know, not making the switch to where the capacity is. And that just goes to more of that sort of clunkiness in the system. We need to be swifter because the capacity is there, but we're not optimizing it.
Does this process require strong top-down leadership, or is bottom-up leadership, county by county, state by state, the way to handle this?
Well, it seems like what a lot of people are pointing out is that there just isn't visibility into where the capacity is and where the shortages are happening. So if there were sort of a top-down oversight of this, there could be coordination to try to say, hey, you know, this site has shortages of this, but here we have capacity over here. So, you know, so I think a lot of people are kind of calling for more of a national coordination that could help a lot to just iron out these kinks that are causing backlogs.
Are you seeing that coordination and it's just taking a little bit longer to get going, or does there seem to be a lack of coordination?
People I'm talking to definitely cite a lack of a national plan. You know, you do see states having some successes. New York is doing incredible amounts of testing. Louisiana has done a lot of testing as well. In California, in Los Angeles, the mayor just said anyone in LA County can get a test if they have symptoms the same day or the next day. So trying to understand why did they have that capacity, whereas other places you have to be hospitalized in order to get a test. So there's certainly a lot of inequity around the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know in my area, I live in Palm Beach County, Florida, there are two testing facilities. One is brand new, and it just doesn't seem like enough to me. I was wondering, you know, I've been quarantined myself for 5 weeks now. It's not as if this is something we're just hearing about. We've seen it coming on. And yet, again, the testing facilities are just, they don't seem to be as available as I would have guessed that they would be. How do you think Palm Beach County Public Services are handling the situation?
Well, certainly you want to be at a place where everybody who needs a test can get one. So if that's not the situation, then we're not where we need to be. I will say, as an outsider, you know, a reporter who is depending on the public health reporting from different municipalities around the country, I have actually found Florida's to be really great, at least in terms of the state's reporting of their cases. They provide these amazingly comprehensive reports of the characteristics of every case in the state. They also provide really comprehensive reporting on who's doing the testing and how much. And it's just a really great source of information that you don't see from every state. And I've just been really impressed by Florida in that way.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Florida also does a lot of great public health work on, you know, mosquitoes and mosquito-borne diseases. So I've just been impressed by Florida over the years in terms of that public health response.
Well, we sure do get mosquitoes down here.
Right.
No lacking of those. Also, when we spoke last in February, we mentioned biotechs, giant biotechs that are trying to come up with vaccines. And I know a lot has transpired. One company we talked about is Regeneron. Mm-hmm. And they have such an interesting business model, an interesting testing model. I'd like you to tell us a little bit about that and tell us what the latest results are from what they're finding.
So Regeneron has a couple different approaches, and they're moving incredibly quickly. The one we probably talked about in February was this antibody approach, where they're actually developing a brand new drug for COVID-19. The way they're doing that is they have these mice that they've genetically engineered to have human immune systems, and they essentially expose these mice to one of the proteins on the novel coronavirus to get them to develop an immune response. The same way when we are infected with the coronavirus, we develop antibodies to those. So what they're doing is taking those antibodies that the mice generate and sifting through them to find the best ones that could be a potential medicine. Mm-hmm. And this medicine could work either to prevent the disease if you give it to somebody in advance, possibly a healthcare worker, you know, who's at high risk, or it could also be used to treat the disease. And this is an approach that they did successfully for Ebola. So there is a lot of hope they'll be able to do it again here. And since we talked, they've accelerated their timelines on being able to get into human trials. Now they're saying by early summer, they hope to be testing this drug in people. But Regeneron is also doing another thing, which is using an existing drug for rheumatoid arthritis to treat the most severe patients with COVID-19. Because they get that inflammation in their lungs mm-hmm. that can really be terrible. And so what they're doing is running clinical trials to see if this rheumatoid arthritis drug, which tamps down that inflammation, can help those patients. And we should see those data within the next couple weeks, pretty soon.
You know, speaking about clinical trials, there's been talk from the president about chloroquine. I don't know if I'm saying mm-hmm. that correct, or hydroxychloroquine. I read that news recently. In a trial in Brazil indicated that they had to stop the trials because a high dose was associated with a regular heartbeat. Where do we stand on, I think that's a pretty controversial drug, but where do we stand on that?
Yeah, we know that drug is being very widely used, both in clinical trials and just in patients who have COVID-19. The heart side effects are known about that drug. So it's not a completely benign drug. So you know, doctors are warning if you have heart issues, that wouldn't be a good patient to try to use this drug for. You know, there are other questions about just, you know, is this doing anything? And what a lot of experts have said is that it is being so widely used, if it were really a silver bullet, we'd probably be seeing that. And we're not. But there are clinical trials ongoing. And what Dr. Anthony Fauci keeps saying is everything's anecdotal until you see the results of these controlled clinical trials
right.
that can really tell us if the drug's working.
Right. Now, there are other companies that are at work at this. I'm just going to name a few. Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, Sanofi, and Gilead Sciences. Now, I'm familiar with Gilead Sciences. Tell us what they're producing and what stage their particular antiviral is at right now.
Right. So Gilead has this drug called remdesivir, which it discovered basically during Ebola and tested for Ebola. Well, it didn't really work very well for Ebola, but they have seen promise in it for the novel coronavirus. They just reported results from 53 patients who had received the drug on compassionate use. So that's for very sick patients who weren't included in clinical trials. So you have to take that data with a grain of yeah. salt because it was not a controlled clinical trial. Mm-hmm. But what doctors are saying is that the data looked hopeful. It showed that 68% of the patients who received the drug showed clinical improvement in terms of how much oxygen support they required. 17 out of 30 patients who were intubated on ventilators in the study were able to come off that mm-hmm. support. But 7 patients included in this group did die. So we're waiting to see the clinical trial data, which Gilead says should be coming later this month. That's the first clinical trial data.
That is a drug that is hoped to cure the virus or cure the person who has the virus and kill the virus while they have it. There's also a lot of talk about vaccines, of course, which are prophylactic in nature. Where do we stand? Now, you mentioned Regeneron and their antibody approach. What other studies, what other drugs are out there to try to solve the vaccine issue?
So there are about 79 vaccines in development for COVID-19. That's according to the Milken Institute, which has this great tracker of all the treatments and vaccines in development. But only a couple have started human clinical trials already. Moderna is this young biotech company that's using a totally new approach called messenger RNA to develop a vaccine. They're partnered with the NIH. They were the first to start human studies. They dosed their first patient in the middle of March. And we should get the data on how safe the vaccine is probably early summer. And then they're going to be starting the next stage of trials to determine whether the vaccine is generating an immune response to be able to protect people against infection. So Moderna says if all goes well, they could have vaccine to use in high-risk groups like healthcare workers by the fall. I mean, that's incredibly fast. It takes years normally to get vaccines ready to be used. And that would be, you know, before you would get a broader FDA approval. That, they think, could come potentially in 2021.
You mentioned these trials, and I know these trials go in phases, phase one, two, and so on. Describe those phases for us.
So typically phase one is a really small study just to look at safety. So you're enrolling healthy people, although when you're doing a vaccine trial, everybody is healthy and you're just trying to prevent them from getting sick.
Right.
So that's phase one. And then typically phase two, you're starting to try to determine the correct dose. You're trying to make sure there's actually an effect that you want to be seeing. That is, you know, a greater number of patients. And then typically phase three is that gold standard clinical trial, sometimes multiple clinical trials that the FDA wants to see to ensure the drug is both safe and effective. And that can involve thousands of patients. It really depends on the indication. So if it's a big thing like a cholesterol drug, that's thousands and thousands of patients.
Right.
If it's a rare disease, it can be fewer. But the FDA is being pretty flexible here because we need to move so quickly. So a lot of these timelines are getting overlapped and abridged. And a big question is going to be, how long do we need to be evaluating these vaccines to really be sure that they're safe?
I'm speaking with Meg Terrell. She covers the pharmaceutical industry and health emergencies and the like for CNBC. Now, of those 70 or so companies that are trying to create a vaccine, three companies are in trials. There's one large Chinese company that's in phase two, now that we know what phase two is. And then there's two U.S. companies in phase one. So that phase one is very, very early. Moderna is the one that you just mentioned, and Inovio Pharmaceuticals is also in phase one. It seems like so few have gotten, you know, really not that far. Why is it taking so long to get even into phase one trials?
Well, they need to develop these new vaccines and get them to a place where they feel comfortable injecting them into a human. So I would say the timelines are faster than we've ever seen before. I mean, I think for Moderna, it was something like 41 or 42 days between when they had the sequence of the virus and between when they shipped the first batches to be dosed into humans. That's amazing. You know, Johnson & Johnson is another giant company working on this, and they plan to be in human trials in September. And that's an accelerated timeline from what they initially saw, too. But what they have to do is design the vaccine, the thing that they're going to inject into people to show the immune system this protein that they want to train it against so that when it encounters the virus, it already has its antibodies, its immune soldiers all primed up and ready to be looking for it to be able to neutralize the virus.
Wow. It does sound like a war. Actually, the terminology is warlike as well, right? Get the soldiers ready. Now, I have also read that these vaccines, you know, we're used to getting a vaccine maybe for life, like the polio vaccine, those kinds of vaccines. But these vaccines would have to be administered quite more frequently. How would that work?
Well, it's not totally clear yet how often that would have to be done. But for Regeneron's, for example, it's not a typical vaccine. So it's creating these antibodies, and they don't know how long the antibodies will last yet. I mean, it's another question that we're trying to understand about our own immune response to this virus. How long will our immune response last? And if we're exposed, does that mean we're really immune? We don't know that yet. But for Regeneron's, you know, Georgine Coppolis, the chief scientific officer, was saying perhaps a month, and you'd have to be dosed again every month. They're figuring that out now. In terms of the other more traditional vaccines in development, we'll have to see that too. How long do these antibodies last that we generate in response to this vaccine? We just don't know yet.
You also interviewed a CEO of a German company, QIAGEN, that seemed to be working on a different kind of program. Tell us about that.
Well, QIAGEN is a testing company, and so they provide the tests to see if you have the coronavirus. They also provide the materials to run the test. And that's been a really big question because we hear from labs that the materials are in shortage. And that's one of the reasons why we can't get these tests.
What kind of tests are they? Is there something about the tests that makes them more attractive? Is the result time shorter? Is the administering of the test a little bit easier on the patient?
Well, so there are all kinds of different tests out there. The QIAGEN ones in particular, you don't hear about them being as widely used as things like the Abbott test, for example. The QIAGEN test, you know, it's a PCR test used to determine whether you currently have the infection. I believe that they can do the turnaround time in about an hour. So that's good. You don't hear that these tests are as widespread as tests like the Abbott test. Abbott has these instruments in tons of labs around the United States, and they're providing thousands or millions of these tests. So those are a little bit more accessible. And what's kind of interesting about some of the Abbott ones is, of course, we've heard about this point of care test that can give you a result in 5 to 13 minutes. That can be really amazing for people who need to know right away. For example, you know, in the doctor's office, trying to make a decision about what to do with somebody.
So much of reopening this economy, I think, is going to have to be a factor of testing, of being able to get tests often. I was thinking maybe even having a QR code on your phone, which shows you when you were tested and that you were cleared, in order for businesses to open up, for people to do transactions again. Are we seeing anything coming on that strongly? You mentioned the Abbott labs. I think, you know, 5 to 15 minutes turnaround is fantastic. Any more technology being used in this particular area to get us up and running again?
Well, that's a really great question. When it comes to the tests to determine if you're currently infected, the problem is the capacity, that we just don't have the ability to run enough of these tests to be able to do what you said, which would be amazing. One of the new areas of technology that's emerging is antibody tests. So that's a test to determine if you've been infected in the past and you have these antibodies. A lot of people see that as basically an immunity test. Like, if I've already had the infection, I'm immune. We just don't know if that's true yet. It's expected it will be true, but it needs to be proven that you can't be reinfected right away with this coronavirus. But again, Abbott, a huge test maker, just announced today that it's going to be launching an antibody test tomorrow. And it'll be supplying millions of tests by June to the U.S. So I think a lot of people are very hopeful that that will be kind of a passport showing you have immunity. You can be back out in the world. And we all hope that's the case.
So the timeline is June, early summer, we heard earlier when you were mentioning Regeneron. So really, we're probably talking fall or maybe later this year before anything of consequence happens. Finally, one point you wrote about was that Massachusetts plans to hire 1,000 people to conduct coronavirus contact tracing. What is contact tracing?
Yeah, this is really interesting. So contact tracing is sort of public health 101, figuring out who has come into contact with people who have been infected and getting in touch with those people and assessing their risk and telling them if they need to potentially isolate or get tested themselves. So Massachusetts is hiring, along with Partners in Health, a nonprofit group, up to 1,000 of these contact tracers, essentially trying to put into place what could be a surveillance system that a lot of public health experts say we need for when we are starting to come out of this, being able to keep an eye on, you know, who might be infected and making sure people stay home if they're at risk, and really just trying to keep a lid on potential outbreaks. You know, you're hearing people saying we're going to need hundreds of thousands of these kinds of folks doing this in the U.S., so it would be a really big effort.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on today and giving us such a comprehensive look at the state of the art. Hopefully we can have you on in another 30 days or so, and we can kind of keep track with this. My guest is Meg Terrell. Thanks, Meg. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
As you know, my mission is always to educate my listeners, and I remind you week after week, segment after segment, that we love your questions, because we do. These are complicated times, which makes for complicated topics, and I'm always here to answer them. So, if you have questions about your portfolio, your kids' kids, your retirement, your 401k, how to take better care of your family, anything financial on your mind, I'm here with over 35 years of experience, and I'd love to help you in any way I can. Go to stevepomerantz.com, go to the contact section, and let me know how we can help. That's stevepomerantz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Terry, what's going on in your world? I mean, the rest of us are quarantined and trying to stay out of trouble. What are you doing?
Well, I am quarantined and I'm looking to get into trouble. Yeah. So the world of real estate, things have definitely quieted down. And that's, of course, across the country. But when we look at the numbers in Palm Beach County, what I've been tracking, Steve, is I want to keep an eye on what's going under contract and how many new listings are coming on. So let's just take, for example, since March 31st and today's the 14th, we'll just say for a 12-day period of time, We brought in 209 new pending sales the 1 week, and then 217. So you're looking at, say, 425 new contracts, if you will.
Okay.
And about, say, 700, a little over 700 new listings. So, you know, what am I saying by all of this? There's new listings still coming on the market, and buyers and sellers are coming together and, you know, bringing contracts under contract.
Yeah, but like we talked about last week, the whole way it's being done has got to be totally changed.
It's totally changed. You know, we're doing a social distancing. We're wearing gloves, you know, in some cases, booties, masks, depending on the house, if it's vacant. And quite frankly, no one's supposed to be in the house. The seller's not supposed to be in the house. We're not really even supposed to enter the house with the client.
Yeah.
We have certain rules that we're adhering to, and we're able to do so much now digitally. We can do Zoom conferences. We can write contracts electronically. And it's interesting. You know, when we first went into this, we had the shock and awe, okay, how are we going to do our business? And I ran out and videoed all my properties, and I'm calling them virtual walking tours. Mm-hmm. And we have them available for people to take a look at. And as we kept rolling on, things, you know, started off like, how are we going to do our business? Now it's almost becoming like, this is the new norm. And it's starting to feel comfortable in that, you know, you develop a new rhythm in the way that you wake up in the morning and, yeah, and how you start your day and what you're doing. You know, how are you going to get in touch with your buyers, your sellers? And it's an interesting phenomenon.
Are sellers letting buyers in their homes?
Some do, some don't. It really depends on their health and their situation. obviously, the more motivated the seller, they're allowing it, and we're just taking extra precaution.
Okay.
The homes that are vacant, I'll give you an example. I took a vacant property up for sale, and we priced it aggressively. We had one figure in mind right before the coronavirus. We were going to go in at $295, which we thought was a good number, pricing it well. Well, when we actually rolled it out on Friday, right before Easter, we put it on the market for $275. Friday, Good Friday and Holy Saturday, we had over 30 showings. There were people, agents, lining out the door to show this property. And we ended up with, you know, five offers. We sold it for $28,000 over asking. So the moral of the story is, if it's priced right, especially if it's a vacant property, they're moving.
Now, was that a function of the price point? Because I know in months past, you've said that the price point sales picture is quite different depending upon where you are and what level you're at.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is entry-level house, and there's such a strong demand for it. And when one is in excellent condition, well cared for, and shows well, and you've got some great pictures and photography and walking tours, and everybody is able to see it, that was all contributing factors. And if, quite frankly, if it wasn't for the pandemic situation that we're in, I would have sold it just as fast. Not sure that it would have gotten the number that we got. So it just hammers down the point that if it's priced properly, it will sell. Even if it's a higher price point, we went and showed a house the other day, and it was in the 800 range, Steve, and they priced it aggressive. This seller is relocating, has to sell. We were the second person in, and they sold it that day to the first person in.
Oh, why? Now, getting back to this $290,000, so what was the final price on that?
$303,000.
Okay.
We asked $275,000, and we sold it for $303,000.
Now, was that a cash deal, or was there a mortgage on that?
No, there's actually a mortgage, and that brings up another interesting topic. So I didn't have any cash buyers. The investors weren't looking at it. It was all end users. And we had the five offers, and we had to decide who was the strongest financially. And, you know, what I've come to realize in all of this, what's really important is, where is the income being derived? So the offer that we ended up accepting was a person who is on disability, and part of his income is from the government. So we know that his income is constant. Where if we had accepted another person's offer where they have, you know, a job, we don't know that their income is going to remain constant in the next 30 days. And what's happening, Steve, is the banks are the day before closing re-verifying that the borrower is still gainfully employed, that their income is still the same, and that they don't foresee any changes in their employment status.
So you have a situation where a buyer may be pre-approved for a loan, or approved, not pre-approved.
Approved for their loan. They've already got mortgage commitments.
And now, because of the virus, the day of closing or the day before, the bank is checking their source of income to see whether they have a job or will have a job?
Yes, that's correct. A couple days before closing, they're re-verifying everything. They're re-verifying proof of income, money in the bank. So interestingly enough, with our contract, if you've already been approved for your finance, you have 30 days to get a mortgage commitment, you get your mortgage commitment, you're locked and loaded. So if the deal were to fall apart, the buyer loses out. The money is forfeited to the seller. Yeah. So in this particular case, if that were to happen, which really isn't fair, the deposit money can go to the seller and no fault of the buyer.
Yeah, that brings up all kinds of problems, which we'll get to next week, but unfortunately we're out of time. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton. And she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. With all that's going on in the world, we're adding another fun segment to close out the show. This one takes us through the origin of the speed of communication we now take for granted. Or perhaps right now we're trying to block out what with the ceaseless 24/7 chatter about the pandemic. So come back in time with me as we look at the determined entrepreneurs that laid the first transatlantic cable. It's a great story of trials, tribulations, and a few foreign entanglements to boot. Hope you enjoy. Today, in a world in which news flashes around the globe in an instant, time lags are inconceivable. In the mid-19th century, communication between the United States and Europe, which was the center of world affairs back then, was only as quick as the fastest ship could cross the Atlantic, making the United States isolated and vulnerable. But in 1866, the old and new worlds were united by the successful laying of a cable across the Atlantic. My guest is John Steele Gordon, who has written many books chronicling the growth of America, The Scarlet Woman of Wall Street, A History of Wall Street in the 1860s, Hamilton's Blessing, The Extraordinary Life and Times of Our National Debt, The Great Game, The Emergence of Wall Street as a World Power, 1653 to 2000, and A Thread Across the Ocean, The Heroic Story of the Transatlantic Cable. Now, I read A Thread a few years ago, and it seems I'm going through a phase of understanding the historical context of our world today. And John Steele Gordon's book chronicles this extraordinary achievement that changed our world forever. And I have him on the show with me right now. Welcome, John.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
John, is a great book, and I've now just recently reread it. And again, it holds up really quite well. What was the state of communications between the old world and the new?
Well, they have been improving throughout the 19th century. In 1800, a ship could, the average time going from America to England was about 6 weeks, and going the other way was about 8 weeks, but if the weather was really lousy, it could be 3 months. By the middle of the 19th century, they had steamships, and the time frame was going down and down and down. By the 1860s, it was about 10 days for the fastest ship.
So all of the news that was happening in Europe, any wars or volcanoes like Krakatoa and so on, nobody really knew about that for quite a long period of time, correct?
Yes, and it could be 2 weeks before you heard some big news that happened in Europe.
You know, you wrote in your book that when people came to the United States, they basically had to stay here. There was really no going back, except for a few business people and elites. Traveling back and forth between the old and new world was literally impossible. So what was the kind of person, and this is rhetorical, I have to ask myself, what was the kind of person that would make that one-way trip knowing not what faced them in the new world at this early period of time in our country's history, but the fact that this was basically it, almost all ties to the old world were cut. And there was this tremendous desire now to try to bring the two worlds together. Now, a lot of things were happening both in England and in the United States in the early 1800s. New England was going through a tremendous upsurge in manufacturing in the Industrial Revolution. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Industrial Revolution began in England in the middle of the 18th century. Historians are forever arguing about exactly when. It's not very important, which is why they argue about it. In the United States, the Industrial Revolution began very early in the 19th century with cotton mills in New England, where they had quickly flowing rivers that could power it. And that became a very big industry, and that it's, you know, it was growing quickly in the United States, but England was still by far the industrial powerhouse of the world.
Mm-hmm. And they were expanding their own empire to faraway, you know, lands and climes and so on, right? So England reached how far?
England reached around the world. I mean, it was literally true that the sun never sets on the British Empire. It was the biggest empire in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm. Also, we were starting to create electricity through the use of steam and other technologies, which started to improve manufacturing of cotton and other things as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, the steam engine was what really powered the Industrial Revolution. because it was the first new form of work doing energy since the windmill, which was invented in the 7th century AD. Here was, you know, you turn a low value energy, heat, into something that can move things. And it transformed the world and rapidly developed a new kinds of steam. I mean, the Watt steam engine was obsolescent by early 19th century. So they had a new kind of steam engine called often called a puffer engine, because it exhausted the steam in both the upstroke and the downstroke. So it made a puff noise, and that was powerful enough to move railroads. And that meant that you could move freight overland cheaply and quickly.
Right.
And that was a big revolution.
It was also the harnessing of electricity at that point in time. I mean, we all know about Benjamin Franklin and the kite experiment with the key. And, you know, electricity was discovered early on. It was not understood early on. But this idea that you could actually move electricity through a cable was important, or through a wire was important. Tell us about that.
Well, indeed, at that time, electricity was not well understood, although we understood it much better by the 1840s than we had in Franklin's day.
Yeah.
But we knew that, you know, it could be transmitted long distances down a wire, and the trick was to find a way to use that as a signal. And it was Samuel Morse who, you know, there were lots of people, there was one in England and stuff, but Morse came up with the Morse code, which was a marvelously simple way to transmit information through a wire. And, you know, once you learn Morse code, if you're good at it, you can interpret it by ear. And so good, you know, trained telegraphers would simply, they listen to the Morse code and just write it down. And so this could move information. And it started 1844 from the Capitol building in Washington. He telegraphed to his partner up in Baltimore, "What hath God wrought?" And it then took over by the 1850s. Telegraph lines were reaching all the way down to New Orleans and up into Canada and what have you, and of course also in England and Europe.
So these were overland wires in which the electricity traveled pretty easily, very fast. And there was a lot of talk about trying to lay some underground or underwater cable in order to bridge straits and, you know, small seas and other things. And that was actually happening on the European continent by this point. Right?
Yes. Well, they wanted to lay a cable under the English Channel. So that's only about 25 miles or even less than that. And actually, the first time they did it, a French fisherman accidentally caught it in his net and pulled it up and didn't have any idea what it was. So he cut a piece out to take home and show people. And that was the end of that cable. But pretty soon it was working. And then it was Cyrus Field who, he said, you know, boy, that's a great idea. Why don't we lay a cable across the Atlantic Ocean? And he said later that if he had known anything about it, he would never have started because it was sort of like, you know, somebody reading about Sputnik in 1957 and saying, hey, let's send a manned expedition to Mars. I mean, it was just an order of magnitude more complex and probably two orders of magnitude more expensive.
Cyrus Field is the main protagonist in the story. Who was he?
Cyrus Field came from a remarkable New England family. One of his brothers, Stephen Field, sat on the U.S. Supreme Court. Another was David Dudley Field, who was probably the greatest lawyer of the 19th century and wrote the Field Code of Civil Procedure, which is now used around the whole English-speaking world.
Right.
And so Cyrus Field went into business, and he became a paper manufacturer and made a fortune. And, you know, he was one of those people who always had to be doing something new. Once the paper company was up and running and throwing off money, just running it was boring.
Yeah.
And so he went to South America with a great artist. Sorry, I just can't think of his name off the top of my head. And then he read about the cable and he said, let's do that. And he started, and he was, you know, once he got the bit in his teeth, he just wouldn't stop until he succeeded. Frederick Church is the artist.
Yeah. There's a quote in your book that he had the desire to own the means of instant communication, which I thought sounds like a very modern phrase, this idea of instant communication. He wanted to be the first, and, you know, he obviously, there were many drivers, but not the least of which was to continue to build his fortune. So he basically put together a consortium of pretty well-known people at the time. I know Samuel Morse was involved on his board or in this initial group. Peter Cooper, who formed the Cooper Union, if you're If you know of New York, you'll know the Cooper Union. It's actually where Lincoln spoke and basically became noticed by the world after the Cooper Union speech. Who else was involved in this consortium that we may or may not be familiar with?
There were a bunch of New York businessmen, most of whose names are now pretty much forgotten. There was the head of the Citibank. There was the head of one of the gas companies that was supplying, you know, gas for lighting. People like that, their names are now no longer, you know, in current use. But they were a group of the richest men in New York, which meant they were the richest men in the country.
So what were the difficulties? I mean, there were numerous attempts. Let's talk about the first attempt. Seemed very naive looking back at this thing. What was the cable made up of? How did they insulate the cable? I mean, there's all these considerations. And really, how did they roll the cable out through all of this 2,500 miles they were trying to cover?
Well, the first cable was very badly designed because they didn't know how to design it. There was a steep learning curve to climb here. It was heavy in terms of its volume. And what it was a strands of copper wound around each other. And then insulation, there was iron used to, you know, armor the cable. And then it was insulated with a stuff called gutta percha, which came from a tree in Asia. Basically, it's a kind of plastic. Mm-hmm. And it was used for lots of things. It would harden. And they used it to make walking sticks. And they also discovered that it made much better golf balls. And so, and it was, you know, it was basically the first plastic. It came from a tree. It wasn't, you know, created chemically, but still it was functionally a plastic.
The quality of the ships back then also were a problem as well, right?
Well, they simply weren't big enough. There was no ship in the world that could carry 2,500 miles of cable. And so the British used one of their warships, and we used the Niagara, which was one of America's biggest and best warships. And the original theory was that the British would start in Ireland, and we would start in Newfoundland, and we'd meet in the Atlantic and splice the two together.
The first attempt, there was a lot of celebrating, a lot of newspaper accolades, but it was an utter failure, right?
Yes, they got about 400 miles and dropped the cable, and they couldn't find it again, and that was the end of that. Yeah.
Cable broke, 400 miles of cable irretrievably lost.
Yeah, and so they did it the next year.
Yeah, okay.
They tried again the next year, and this time they decided to, you know, start in Ireland and go to the mid-Atlantic, and then they would meet up, splice the cable there, then continue to Newfoundland. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they ran into a horrendous storm, and both ships barely survived.
Right.
And so they had to abandon them. The next year, in 1858, they actually succeeded in getting the cable across to Newfoundland. And Newfoundland had already been connected by telegraph from Nova Scotia across what's known as the Cabot Strait at the entrance to the St. Lawrence River. And so once they got to Newfoundland, then they were connected to the American telegraph network, and everything was supposed to be fine. And they had a huge celebration, had a big parade up Broadway. They set off fireworks from New York City Hall, burnt the cupola on the top of City Hall. They almost lost the whole building. And Queen Victoria sent a message to President Buchanan. It was 99 words, and it took 16 hours to transmit.
Which they didn't tell anybody. They didn't tell anybody that they were having problems transmitting. They just said it's working, and the Queen Victoria message actually got across. But actually, what happened then?
Well, what happened was they kept having to repeat it. I mean, basically, the guy at the other end kept saying, what? You know, retransmit.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was just barely detectable. And then after about 10 days, the cable just stopped. You know, it was dead as a doornail.
All this celebration, all of this, the newspaper accolades, and then it stopped. And then actually, everything just turned against the whole plan. There were claims of fraud. Cyrus Field was scorned, and yet he said, we'll do it once again.
One thing is very important. This is 1858. This is in 1857, there had been the Great Indian Mutiny had broken out, the greatest crisis of British India in the 19th century. But by 1858, it was winding down, and a regiment that was stationed in Canada had been ordered to India. And during that 10-day time frame when the cable was still working, Britain was able to send a message to Canada saying, don't send that regiment. We don't need it. And thereby saving about £300,000, which is a lot of money in the mid-19th century. So Britain realized the extreme utility of undersea cables because they had a worldwide empire to run. You know, we needed it just because we'd like to get the latest news from Europe more quickly, but Britain needed it to run their empire. And so they were willing to continue. And what they did actually was they sat down and figured out what had gone wrong. What have they done wrong? So they won't make the same mistake again. This is how we've done this ever since. Just like when an airplane crashes, we go to a great deal of trouble to figure out exactly why that plane crashed and how can we stop another such accident happening again. That's what they did this time. And it greatly improved. They also got help from a man named William Thompson, who was a professor of physics in Scotland, and he later became Lord Kelvin. The Kelvin scale of temperature is named for him.
Yep.
He was one of the greatest physicists of the 19th century, and he helped design a new cable that was, it was fatter around, but it was lighter. I mean, it came closer to floating than the old one had, which was very important, made it less likely to break.
This is a great story. Unfortunately, we're out of time. The final part of this story is that there was substantial success in 1866, and money transactions were now being equalized between London and New York, and there were two worlds that were starting to come together. My guest is John Steele Gordon. The book is A Thread Across the Ocean, The Heroic Story of the Transatlantic Cable. And if you have a question about what we just discussed, ask us. Go to stevepomerantz.com. Ask us anything you'd like at stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update where we will send you the weekly commentaries and interviews straight to your inbox. John Gordon, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by The Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which The Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.